Hello, everybody. This is Patrick Sullivan with Archer Gray's PLM Quick 30. Thanks for spending some time with us to talk about all things PLM. And today we have a return visitor. So we didn't offend her at all. Heather Pomerine is back for the attack. Her title is Senior Principal Engineer at Northrop Grumman. And if you haven't listened to the previous episode, she tackled a tough topic, but very popular, model-based design in this whole discussion of digital thread and digital transformation. Many organizations dream of implementing model-based design, and Heather is one of the few that has implemented it successfully. So you will not want to miss a lot of the knowledge that she dropped in that last episode. So today she's joining us to talk about options and variance, which I know is a very relevant topic for lots of organizations who are trying to implement efficiency in their design and engineering processes. So we're excited to have you back, Heather. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So I know some folks may not go back and listen to that model-based design if it's not applicable for them. So would you mind taking a few moments here and introducing yourself, Heather, and giving everybody some background?
Sure. Like you said, my name's Heather Pomerine. I am an engineer with Northrop Grumman. My background originally was in space systems with Northrop. Just recently transferred out to the defense portion of the business. So looking to... been implementing a lot of what I've previously implemented in the last location into the new location here. My background, I have a broad background in the model-based definition, like we're going to talk about today, options and variance as it applies in Windchill and in Creo, just lots of that digital thread. So.
Yeah, awesome. Great. So thanks for that intro. So I'm curious, and I know we touched on the topic, and I think I asked you the question of what digital transformation means to you, but I keep talking with individuals about digital thread, okay? And since you brought it up first, I'm curious to know, when you say digital thread, can you give some context around that, please?
Sure. So, you know, in my broad scheme of things, digital thread can be created, you know, for different entities and processes. It follows a product through the lifecycle, design and inception through engineering, product lifecycle management, and manufacturing instructions, supply chain, through service history, and customer events. So it really enables you to, you know, anticipate and effectively communicate, you know, up and down stream of where the product is in its life cycle, really making sure that everybody utilizes that most current data set and, you know, reaction time is on point.
Yeah, that's great. I love that you mentioned that everybody's able to access the most current data set, because that's very relevant. In fact, at the PTC User Tech Committee meeting, we actually ended up giving a presentation on where is your digital thread broken. And so we kind of went through that, although we displayed it in a linear fashion, like you just described, from, you know, concept to design to manufacturing on down the line. We had specific examples branching down of, you know, artifacts along the way and how the information builds on each other.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody's interpretation of what may be a digital asset or a physical asset. And, you know, the simple question of, is a PDF digital? Which we had people live survey. Some people considered it digital, and then others thought, hey, is it dynamic? And so, you know, the debate started from there.
Oh, yeah. That is a hot topic. But, in my point of view, and obviously everyone has their own, entitled to their own opinion, my point of view, PDF is outdated the minute it's created. So, you know, I prefer to not rely on PDFs if possible.
You are going to get so many emails after that comment. you know, our conversation of trying to level set it was, is the information something that you can consume and pass on in a digital fashion where people can leverage it in an efficient way? And you're right, PDF, as soon as you create it, it's a dead artifact that's disconnected. So, you know, let's bring this back a little bit to the topic of options and variants. And for some folks who may be new to the topic, I think that's probably a good place to start before we start, you know, kind of diving into it. So, Heather, can you explain to everybody who's listening what options and variants means and why we might be talking about it on this podcast?
I would say in kind of general terms, with options and variants, you're going to be able to manage lots of different configurations under one base model, or what we call the overloaded BOM or overloaded model, with predefined requirements. So we'll, within the context of that model, we'll define all of the parameters, all of the constraints for every different option possible. It's also going to allow for more robust and efficient design and collaboration, and to quickly output variant deliverables kind of on demand as a customer needs one. So you don't have to actually go in and save a copy anymore, make your updates. You can do it within the context of Windchill and configure the WT part to the spec that you need to create.
So can you give, you know, if you step back and think about the product in and of itself, and then help some folks visualize what options of variants would be in terms of a product? Is that question clear, by the way?
Like different colors or different...
Yeah, like for instance, we were working with a client that was in the automotive industry, and they were interested in pursuing options and variants related to creating greater efficiencies of how they could turn around estimates to clients from their sales team to their engineers, but the sales team couldn't provide estimates without collaborating with the engineers. And so what used to take 3 or 4 weeks to turn an estimate around was shortened down into, you know, we went through different phases of it, but it was ultimately shortened to days versus, you know, 3 or 4 weeks because of options of variance. So for instance, what kind of chassis, there's only a few options of variance that can exist for that specific model, like you had said earlier. And so, you know, seats, color associated to it. So, you know, that would be an example, you know, at least from my perspective, that I would kind of explain. And that's through the eyes of automotive, but you're in aerospace and defense. So I'd be interested to hear an example, you know, from your perspective.
You know, so for example, we deal with different heights of things. So we might have different station heights for the same component. So it's the same component, just assembled at a different height offset from a generic plane. So, you know, various things like that, that, you know, depending on what it is that we're building, we may scale it, but it's going to be pretty much the same deliverable aside from maybe a couple of items that then need to stretch with that change.
Got it. Okay, perfect. Thank you. So now that we've got kind of a basis understanding to work from here, what, you know, thinking about a company that may be thinking about implementing options and variants functionality, what are some compelling pain points where the business, well, I guess that the business could use in justifying the investment of implementing options and variants functionality?
Really, at like the lowest level, you know, if you find yourself recreating the same thing over and over again, just with slightly different variations, this is definitely a doable process for you. It doesn't even need to be a full product. You can start with, you know, we know that 75% of our product has 10% variability. Okay, so then that 75% is now built into an options and variants style output. And then on top of that is where you build the rest of your product. So it doesn't need to be a full end product, so to say. You can definitely break it down into smaller subsets.
When you're talking about the potential of investing in implementing options of variance, you're suggesting that it could be broken into even product by product?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Even subsystem by subsystem, however you break down your product, I would say there's a use case for a lot of the industry there.
So I know that you've implemented this in your past. And so what were some of the key factors to help ensure that you were set up to be successful when you implemented it?
I would say actually the number one factor to ensuring success is skeleton usage, 100%. You know, so the way that I went about it, I built up an overloaded BOM in Creo first. So I had all of my options built up into the physical model, and basically everything that I put into that model hung off of a skeleton. So you really have to understand dependencies and things like that, where you really want to make sure that it's all driven from that central skeleton, so that nothing, when it goes to configure, nothing's going to hiccup, nothing's going to fail, because you've now component B that you assemble to component A now can't exist anywhere because component A is not part of that configuration. So now component B fails and you fail that configuration. So definitely skeleton usage. And I would say if you're doing full PLM in Windchill, the other major issue that I wish I had known about when I had done it was making sure that all of the change notices and things like that were executed properly for everything below what I was configuring, which was took a lot of time to fix, because that, you know, that was not a known factor at the time.
All right. So I'm going to rewind a little bit just in case. So I'm assuming that the engineers that are listening know what you're talking about. So for the benefit of the non-engineering folks, can you define skeleton usage a little bit?
So it's kind of like an anchor for your models. It's a central point from which, you know, we hang datums and defining features off of. So within the context of an assembly, I'll have a skeleton. I'll have all of my coordinate systems in that skeleton to which I will assemble the rest of my subcomponents, and all of that, you know, the parametric ability is all contained within the skeleton. So depending on how I want components to move with relation to each other, I'll build that into the skeleton to the coordinate systems, for example. So that's kind of in a nutshell, my main usage of skeletons. Obviously there's motion skeletons and space claims and things like that, but in this context, that is to which I am referring.
Okay, so when you have your overloaded BOM first, which are we equating an overloaded BOM? So how would you phrase it to say overloaded BOM and skeleton usage together? Because you had started saying the first thing without a doubt is skeleton.
Yes.
Skeleton usage, and then you started by, and then you went into your next point of saying that the first thing that you did was built an overloaded BOM. So kind of pull those two together. They're not synonymous, right?
No, but the skeleton goes into the overloaded BOM. So it's basically one end product model within Creo, an assembly that has a skeleton basically at every configurable module level. So there's configurable products at the top level and then modules, and modules can go into products and products cannot go into modules. So all of my products would have skeletons within the context of this, of an assembly. I would put in every possible option, assembly or part wise, configuration wise, within that top assembly, with all constraints for every part or subassembly hanging off of the configurable product skeleton.
And so when you said on your second pain point regarding making sure that the CNs, change notices, right?
Yeah.
Were executed below, are you referring to the some components that are hanging off of the skeleton?
Yep. Every single, and I mean every single component within the context of your overloaded bomb, regardless of whether if it's a tiny little screw or, you know, a much larger subassembly, all of those change notices need to be executed properly. You know, if you have it in your business rules to not have or to make sure that your like WT part revision matches your CAD revision, and those are disconnected because the change notice was implemented incorrectly via a revise function, or someone went into the change notice later and added another, let's say someone went in, started a change notice and only revised CAD without revising the WT part. So now that new revision of CAD is linked to the old revision of the WT part. So then they go in and add the WT part to the change notice, revise that, but now the two new revisions are not linked together. So that in and of itself causes problems with configuring in Windchill.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good.
Yeah, no. So every single issue like that, when it comes time to configure, will rear its ugly head. So if you pay attention to those kinds of things before it becomes a problem, you know, making sure that, you know, the philosophy of why people need to revise and execute their change notices properly up front, you know, it saves you time in the long run when it comes time to do options and variants, because then you don't need to do, you know, product structure compare, build functions or anything like that.
That sounds like one of the big lessons learned. I mean, you set it up front around CNs, but I'm sure you probably have a big playbook that you would apply moving forward. It sounds like a lot of trial and error that you had to go through to learn that lesson.
Yep.
No, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. All right, so we talked a bit about what do you need to be ready to implement options and variants successfully, and you don't have to eat the whole elephant at one time. You can take a more methodical approach, right, of approaching one product at a time and thinking about some of these, you know, major aspects that can save you time in the long run, paying attention to how you treat change notices up front so it's not as painful on the backside. So did you have any other big lessons learned or major hurdles that you need to consider when you're thinking about pursuing options and variants?
It really was just the skeletons and the revisions. So making sure those revisions, the revisions between the CAD and the WT parts matched up. But therein lies like what I've been advocating for a while is philosophy of product structure, where if we can kind of focus in on that to begin with, and we build up a strong product structure, your model integrity is on point all through change management, then it all becomes a moot point in the end. So it really does come down to those two things, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's great. If those are the major blocks to pay attention to, then let me kind of tie in this idea of, you know, transforming an organization, because options and variants is definitely a different way of approaching your product design, right? And so oftentimes when executives decide to fund something, they fund it with the mindset of there's a start and an end. Is there one for options and variants?
No. I mean, there's obviously a start because, you know, you need to draw that line in the sand, but there really is no end unless, you know, you say, you know, there's an end of life here and that we're not going to be producing any more products up to this point. But, you know, literally, but as far as it goes, I would say it's definitely like a stepping stone down the path of digital transformation, to be poetic. You know, it is a piece of that digital thread that gets you one step closer to, you know, a model-based enterprise in the end. And it doesn't need to be part of your enterprise view, but it definitely does aid in the long run, you know, especially if you have a lot of reuse in your industry.
Thinking about that idea that there is no end related to it, I feel like a lot of organizations underestimate the amount of effort that an investment needs to keep it alive. Like, you know, that's why I say, you know, beginning and end, like everybody goes back to their normal day of work, but it's a new way of working that requires love, care, feeding, right?
And yes, it's like a house plant.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, what would you say are some of those essentials when you're thinking about that this is a journey? What are some of those essential things to ensure that, you know, your options and variants way of working is not only successful when it's first launched, but more importantly, sustained?
Definitely, you know, you want to make sure that there is going to be a lot of time spent upfront in this setup. That's a given. There's a lot of time spent there, majority of the time. But as far as sustainment goes, you know, you want to make sure that as you're making these changes or you're applying change notices to your overloaded BOM, that they're done methodically, because there's a lot more contained within the BOM and within that model than normal. That becomes a task in and of itself, is just ensuring that everything is captured that needs to be captured whenever you're going to be rolling a revision or something like that. So we're applying the change, you know, if you need to add a part or make a new configuration, that every aspect is addressed before that's rolled out or before it's reconfigured, knowing where the change needs to be applied. So is it a global change that you just apply to the top level and it doesn't need to be as part of a choice or something like that when it comes time to configure in Windchill? Or does it only need to be applied to certain variants? That kind of methodical work needs to take place down the line. So the users need to have a broader scope of understanding of the whole product, not just of one variant. So that's really important.
Are there products that aren't appropriate for options variants that, even though they could benefit from an efficiency standpoint, to your point about users need to have a broader understanding of the overall product to understand the option, the ins and outs of options and variants. Are there some products that you could see that, although it would be beneficial, just aren't conceivably, it just can't be done to your point about the broader scope and the impact associated to the overall model?
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of anything specific off the top of my head, but you know, I definitely think maybe just if it's a super small product that you're trying to configure, you know, weigh the time to value. That's really the biggest hurdle for that. I can't think of a specific product.
That's okay. It came to mind as you were starting to think about it, and I thought, oh, wow, you know, when you start to think about some of these larger products that are very complex, is it, and also the larger the product, oftentimes the more variants that you could have.
Unless
it's engineered to order, then options and variants may not be applicable.
Right. But then, you know, so therein lies the balance, you know, because depending if you go the overloaded BOM route, you know, having to maintain, if you have a very large model, having to maintain that in CAD can get very cumbersome. So that balance needs to be there as well. You know, there comes a point where, well, now we've built entirely too much variability into it that there isn't any benefit long run. So, you know, you need to weigh your how much variability do you want to build into it and kind of stick with it? And once you create, you know, it needs to become its own standalone model at that point.
How do you ensure that all the rules that were established up front, you know, with regards to, you know, making that sure that the skeleton and revisions match, how do you ensure that all rules are being followed? When you're setting this up, is a large portion of it automated, or people need to understand the cause and effect of how the initial configuration was originally set up and the intent related to it?
Oh, yeah. No, 100% the latter. I'm a firm believer in making sure that people understand why they need to do things a certain way. There might be 6 1/2 dozen ways to get from A to B, but they all have background consequences that they don't know about. But there is one way to get from A to B that yields the best result, and they need to know why they need to go that way. So it really boils down to transparency into the users, and so they know why they need to do it a certain way, and explain to that to them up front. Because if you just say you need to do it this way without any explanation, they're not really going to listen. They're going to go off and find a better way to do it that might be faster, or, you know, they might like better, but in the end it causes more problems and they don't know that. So
how do you help ensure, well, how do you help avoid those scenarios? I mean, you had mentioned education upfront as to the why, and I don't know if consequences is, you know, but the trade-offs, well, if they detour.
I actually got to the point where I would actually record myself on the computer, you know, showing the repercussions of what happens. And then I would push that out and say, this small mistake that took you 5 seconds took me 10 minutes to fix. And this is what goes into that. So at that point, you know, it really kind of sunk in when they could actually see the work that goes into, you know, fixing some of these mistakes. And, oh, maybe I will pay a little bit more attention to what I'm doing next time. But
does it ever trickle down to production?
No. It hasn't gotten that bad, but
I mean, could it conceivably? I mean, not to say specifically with you, but yeah. If people don't have tighter controls and they're not following the governance that was originally put forth, even though they may have been educated, into your earlier point that it's just faster, could they can push it through? It may get approvals, but it could have huge consequences.
Then, yes, because, you know, if like I said earlier, if you are fully PLM and you are releasing your data in Windchill, you know, the shop floor might be looking at one version of CAD as a deliverable, you know, something, their MBD and Creo view. Then they go and they look at the related objects, they pull up an older version of a WT part unbeknownst to them, because that was how that change notice was implemented, obviously incorrectly. It takes them to an older revision, an older, you know, product structure is associated to that. There might be some older documentation that's associated to it. So yes, I can see where that would cause problems down the line. Those kinds of things, though, we did catch ahead of time. So luckily, that never became an issue.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you know, we covered a lot of topics, and, you know, I want to thank you again for jumping on the call. I'm curious, is there anything that we didn't cover that you feel is important to at least mention on this topic of options and variants?
I would say, I guess, two other things. So obviously building your configurable model, your overloaded BOM model, outside of the context of your production model. You know, so you don't want to be building up your overloaded BOM in the context of your upper level assembly, which just causes issues across the board. So, you know, therein lies, you know, where you can apply it in smaller chunks if you want to. So you can take out a subsection, build up your overloaded BOM, configure it and then swap out the new variant in your upper level assembly once that's made. So that makes life a lot easier because you're making this overloaded bomb outside of anything that's being reported to it. So that was pretty important. And then also just something simple like building your own table view within the context of Windchill, like when you're trying to assign your choices. I found that super helpful. So I put all the columns for expressions, and then I would have a column for built from CAD and then the version. So the built from CAD column option was really helpful when it came time, because if I saw something that was not built from CAD as I was going through, I knew that that was a part that needed to be addressed that might have had its change notice improperly implemented. So just little triggers like that really help with that data management.
I mean, it's those small things that end up making a huge difference.
Oh, 100%.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, thanks for sharing those. I'm glad I asked that question. I appreciate that. Definitely for the folks that are, you know, tasked with helping implement or structure, you know, the implementation plan around options and variants, they're going to get huge value out of this topic. I'm glad that you were able to set aside some time to spend with us. So thanks again, Heather. I really appreciate the time and all of your expertise on this topic.
Thank you, Pat.
Any other items you want to address before we part ways?
I think that's it.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks again, Heather, and we will look forward to collaborating more in the future.
Thanks, Pat. Appreciate it.